Good morning to you. I'm Veronica Rickard. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you along this morning. Well, it's Monday, and that means, of course, it's time for All Things Political. Some of the stories on the table today: healthcare reform, of course, Obama's $4 billion school improvement plan, and Sarah Palin stepping down. She's done it. You can weigh in on these and any issues you like this morning with our guest today. His name is Marvin Overby, professor and Frederick A. Middlebush Chair in Political Science at the University of Missouri. Our call-in number this morning, 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or feel free to send us an email to talk@wpr.org. And Marvin Overby, thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Well, let's start off with the big one, healthcare reform. Not too much has happened over the weekend. Some key Democrats, I know, have been talking about how they really do need the help of the GOP to pass this along. Is that a big admission?
I'm not sure it's a big admission. I think it certainly has a lot of truth in it. This is a political hot potato. It's potentially a campaign issue, not just in the next election cycle, but several election cycles down the road. And House Democrats, Senate Democrats, they don't want to be out there exposed on this without at least a modicum of Republican cover. So ideally, they would like to have at least some liberal and moderate Republicans joining them in this, so they can say, look, this is not just a Democratic leap. This is something that had bipartisan support.
Well, and part of Obama's platform going into office was to work with both sides in matters like this to get some sort of consensus so that it wasn't just someone driving it through. But on the other hand, they have the majority, and one would think the power to do it. So how do you think the American public feels about that, about trying to bring in everybody onto the issue?
Well, can we back up for just a second? I'm going to give you sort of a long-winded political science answer, if you
sure,
don't mind.
Go for it.
America has what political scientists classify as a weak state, which means that it's very difficult for a government of the day to enact a policy proposal, especially a radical policy proposal, and then follow through on that to the implementation stage several years, even several decades down the road. If you look at the United States compared to other industrialized democracies, particularly in Western Europe, those states are much stronger, much more of an ability to take a policy stance, to implement that policy stance, and then to follow through on it. For a variety of reasons, the American system just isn't designed to work that way. We have a separation of power system at the federal level, where you have three co-equal branches, you have a bicameral legislature where either chamber can essentially put the kibosh on a policy proposal. But beyond that, there are also many other factors in the American system that make it difficult to follow through on a policy initiative, not the least of which is we have a federal structure where a lot of decisions that might be made at the federal level actually have to be implemented at the state and local level. And there can be a lot of slippage between what the national government proposes and what the local governments actually implement. And if you add to that the fact we have a First Amendment tradition in the United States that gives interest groups a whole lot of latitude in terms of lobbying all the different levels of government for what they want, that essentially means that in the United States, no battle is ever final. And if a group loses at one level, they can fight it out at the next level. If they lose in one branch of government, they can fight it out in another branch of government. If they lose in one House of Congress, they can fight it out in another House of Congress. And so that makes it very difficult for the U.S. to take the kind of policy initiative and follow through on it as President Obama would like to with his health care proposals.
Well, and he has had a lot of political capital and has been spending a lot of it trying to get this health care reform passed before the August break, and it's sort of looking like that ship is going to sail without it being passed.
That's true, and you know, there are several, I think, aspects to this. One is, I believe, that the president realizes that a congressional victory in the short run might be a hollow one if he isn't able to line up support sort of in other areas from other sectors of the public, from other sectors of the political spectrum, to back whatever Congress decides to do. If the Democrats push through a proposal with essentially just Democratic support, they might win in the short term and lose in the long term. I think, you know, another thing is just really worth keeping in mind here is there's an old saying that Congress was not designed to move quickly on its 1,070 feet. I mean, you've got 100 senators, you've got 435 members of the House of Representatives, you've got numerous committees, and they, each of those 535 voting members of the House and Senate, they have other priorities beyond just getting any particular policy proposal through.
Well, and you got the feeling they didn't like the idea of being rushed either. They were pushing back against that, saying, you know, get off our back a little bit here. We're not going to rush something this big.
Well, I think that's true. And I think it's Congress is they're sort of an ethos in Congress that they consider themselves a co-equal branch. They are very jealous of the executive branch on many occasions. They are jealous between the House and the Senate as opposed to who is going to take the lead or who is going to get credit. So there are a lot of dynamics here that are at work beyond just sort of a policy dynamic about what would be a good policy to implement or not.
Well, and the latest sticky wicket coming up that people are debating, I gather, is whether or not the health plans, these health insurance plans, will be affordable even to the uninsured.
Right, and my political instincts tell me that that's probably bad news for the Democrats. It seems like in the last, I don't know, month or so, at least the last couple of weeks, the sort of the focus of the debate has moved almost exclusively to the financial and affordability dimension, and that is something that sort of takes the Democrats' strong suit, their strong cards. Which is the accessibility issue, which is the coverage issue, and instead makes it much more of a fiscal matter. Mm-hmm. And my suspicion is that shifts the playing field much more in the direction of the opposition.
Normally we wait to take calls, but you know what? We've got some calls on health care reform now, so I'm going to go ahead and open the phone lines, and we'll take this first call now from Martin in Madison. Hi, Martin.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would like to make some observations and then listen to your guest comments.
Sure, go ahead.
I actually grew up in the province of Saskatchewan, where health care started in Canada. I had health care from 1961 on. I have, you know, quite a history with health care in Canada. In fact, the politician that the Canadian government uses to head the Royal Commissions every time they study health care in Canada was my father's best friend in law school. So, and I'm a citizen of three countries, the Netherlands, Canada, and here. I've had health care in all three countries. So I have a pretty good understanding of the issues, I think. I've been following it quite closely, the debate here, and what's really come up for me is the example that I have is that in Canada, it did not, healthcare, universal healthcare did not start in the whole country as a whole. It started in one province, and then in a second, and then in a third. And then finally the whole country said, wait a minute, this works. Let's do it for the whole country. And the main thing that's come out of this debate for me is I think making the wholesale changes that need to be made to implement a single-payer system, which is what this country needs, is going to be too difficult to do on a national level. And I thought about it, and I thought, this is the only industrialized country that does not have single-payer health care. And I thought of another issue, oddly enough, which is replacing the dollar bill. This is one of the few industrialized countries that has not replaced the lower bills, because that is something that is much more cost-effective to have coins. Well, this country tried it, and they made a coin that was exactly like a quarter and didn't stop printing the dollar bills. They couldn't even make a fundamental change like that nationally that would save $500 million a year. If they can't make a simple change like that, how are they going to implement health care, the massive changes that needed to be done with the systemic kind of lethargy in legislation passing in this country? And I'll take my comments off the air.
Okay, thank you, Martin. And Marvin Overby, what do you think? Is the analogy there that the states should be taking care of their health insurance plan, going for universal coverage state by state? If we look at Saskatchewan, well, province, of course, not the same as a state, but it's a smaller unit of government.
Right. I'd have several comments to Martin's call-in comments. The first is that that Canada, in some ways, is a very nice comparison for the United States, because unlike most of the other countries we sometimes compare ourselves to, Britain or France or West Germany or Germany or other Western European countries, Canada really is a federal system where the provinces there are roughly analogous to the American states. And so the observation that Canada starts this at the provincial level in Saskatchewan in 1946, I think is a reasonable observation, and we've seen some of that in the United States as well. Massachusetts, for instance, in the last couple of years, implementing a system where they're trying to get essentially all residents of the state covered by health insurance. So I think we've seen some of that in the United States. I think for me, one of the more interesting aspects to Martin's comment is when Saskatchewan decided to begin adopting universal health care coverage. And it's essentially the same time that Great Britain does it, and it's immediately in the wake of World War II. And I think that there's a lesson there that these sorts of massive changes are in many cases easier to implement in the wake of a crisis, in the wake of some essentially cataclysmic event like a world war, when there have been these massive social changes that have been undergone, when there is this and on the part of the Allies in the late 1940s, this sense of coming together, this sense of achievement. And also the displacement you had with the demobilization from the war, putting all sorts of massive pressures on the country's social welfare services. And the upshot of that may be that we may need some sort of crisis of that level, of that magnitude, before we're going to see something done in the United States.
What about the global recession? Maybe not a cataclysm, but certainly something that's got a lot of people really upset.
Yeah, maybe. But the cover of Newsweek, you know, this week has, you know, recession over. I think that has, to a certain extent, passed. I think Americans and many people around the world are still a little nervous about it, but I think that the fears that we were tumbling toward some sort of cataclysmic global financial meltdown, I think that has passed. And Americans in particular, and I think human beings in general, have a notoriously short attention span on these things.
So do you think Obama missed the boat? Did he not ride that healthcare wave? I don't know how he could have done it any faster, honestly, but do you think that he missed the moment, the window that he could have jumped through to make this happen on the wave, maybe of fears and uncertainties tied in with the recession?
Perhaps, although it's unclear to me that he could have done anything differently or better. You know, at the heart of this, and I'm not a specialist on healthcare, I'm not a specialist on healthcare financing or reform, but it does seem to me that underlying a lot of these issues are some basic societal problems that are difficult to deal with strictly with policy responses. And by that I mean we have, for instance, in this country, a very strong belief that problems can be solved technologically, that if you have enough technology, that life can be extended. And we also have, I think, a problem understanding that when it comes to healthcare, you're not dealing with sort of normal market forces, that you don't have in the realm of healthcare the kind of market dynamics that you have when you go out to buy a loaf of bread or a new suit of clothes or whatever, and that you don't really have a producer and a consumer sort of making decisions. In many cases, the producer of the healthcare, the healthcare professionals, are also the consumers, the ones who are the ones in a position to make a decision about what will be consumed. And I think when those factors come into play, it makes it very difficult for us to think about A, rationing healthcare, and B, treating healthcare as a non-market item. Because I think Americans are much more comfortable for a variety of social and historical factors trying to think of this in market terms when it really isn't a market. Hmm. And until we sort of get beyond that, I'm not sure that any president's going to be in a position to push through a major change.
Well, I know that last week President Obama started talking about this in terms of how it would affect your family, sort of taking it down to the personal level. This is what it will mean to your budget. Did that work?
You're talking about the Wednesday night press conference?
Right.
Yeah. I think he had a chance there. I don't think he did a particularly good job in the Wednesday night press conference. I think that he looked tired, and I'm sure he is. It's a tough job. And I'm sure that he is a bit frustrated about the way this policy is playing out. And I think, and I assume we're going to get to this probably later in the hour, I think he also stepped on his headline, as my journalist friends would say, with the last question about Professor Gates. So I think he had the opportunity to try to address that issue, but I don't think he did a particularly good job of it. And I think there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that if you believe the numbers, viewership was down about 15% from his last news conference. So he's not getting as much exposure as he was earlier in his term. And I think if you look at the coverage the next day, the first story was about Professor Gates. The second story, or the third story, was then about the healthcare message in the news conference. But again, these are not the kind of issues, I think, if I'm right about some of the dynamics at play here, these are not the kind of issues that can be resolved simply by a single presidential press conference. These are much more deeply underlying, much more fundamental attitudes in the American public that change slowly.
John in Milwaukee, you are up next. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Morning.
There's so much muddle-headedness here this morning, I don't even know where to begin. Congress is not, and let's put this in very great perspective, a deliberative body, as your guest would have us to believe. When they want to get a war resolution to the president, circa 1917, 1941, and albeit a defective one in 1964, and then again with Bush in 2002, they do it. And they do it with great alacrity. And this issue of health care, it shows just how important Ted Kennedy is and was to this whole process. All but for the illness of Mr. Kennedy, this matter of health care would have been through the Congress, through the Senate, way back in February, March. And because we're missing his leadership, we're in this stew right now that goes back, basically, to 1940, when Walter Reuther negotiated the first private health care insurance with General Motors. And he got a call at that time from FDR saying, "Walter, what have you done? You have pushed national health care reform back a generation." Well, actually, now it's three generations.
What do you think, Marvin Overby?
I think that's a pretty simplistic assessment of the situation. This is not, I think, about any one senator. This is not about Congress sometimes moving more quickly than others. Congress is, I think, in many cases, a deliberative body. It's also a very political body. And the speed with which Congress acts on war resolutions largely reflects their belief that there is extreme public support for taking military action. I don't think in this case, sort of despite the fierceness with which this issue is trumpeted by those on both the left and the right, I don't think that the American public is necessarily at that crisis point yet. And I think that in some cases the Democrats have done themselves a disservice because there is a if you look back over the rhetoric from the past, and a lot of this was being played by the news services around President Obama's Wednesday night press conference. They had these clips from Franklin Roosevelt, from Harry S. Truman, from Bill Clinton, talking about how it was necessary to deal with the health care matter, or the economy would simply be in shambles. I mean, they quoted Bill Clinton from his 1993 State of the Union address, quote, "All of our efforts to strengthen the economy will fail unless we take bold steps to reform our health care system." I think a fair reading of the 1990s is that we did not take bold measures to reform our healthcare system, and yet the economy did reasonably well, if not very well, during that decade. So the American public, I think, looks at some of this rhetoric with a very jaundiced eye. They have heard Wolf cried about this a number of times, and so they are not at the point where they see this as the kind of crisis that is necessarily necessitates immediate action.
Well, what about John's charge that Ted Kennedy would have been pivotal here? I know you said this is bigger than one senator, but we're talking about a real firebrand there. Could this have gone a different way, maybe hitting the August deadline if he had been there?
I doubt it. These are institutions, and individuals make differences, but generally at the margins. It's difficult for me to see how Ted Kennedy's presence is going to change the underlying political calculus that any elected official in the United States is going to be making. They want to get these elected officials, members of the Senate and members of Congress, they want to get a sense of where this is politically. That's one of the reasons they want to delay this a bit in some cases. They want to be able to go back to their states and districts in the August recess. They want to get some sense, not just of what the general public believes and supports, but where their supporters are on this matter. It's a very complicated issue. I think the public has only sort of a very vague understanding of what's going on. And so members of Congress want to get a sense of where this is. And I don't see how Ted Kennedy's presence as a more sort of forceful figure in this debate would change those underlying calculations at all.
Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break right now and then come back. Continue with Monday's All Things Political with Marvin Overby, professor and Frederick A. Middlebush Chair in Poli-Sci at the University of Missouri. And we'd love to get your voice in on this morning as well, whether you want to talk about health care reform, we can talk some more about that, or you want to talk about President Obama's $4 billion school improvement plan, or maybe Sarah Palin. Whatever it is, big news stories are our topic today, and you can give us a ring at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send us your email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Veronica Rickert, back with you this Monday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in all this week for Kathleen Dunn. And I hope you'll stay with me after 10 o'clock. You know, we've heard about the recession. Have you heard of the he session? Well, we'll be talking about that next hour. As our guest says, the fall of the financial sector, the loss of jobs, and the psychological frailty of unmarried men is going to lead to the end of the macho culture. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. Right now, we're talking all things political with Marvin Overby, our guest this morning. He's a professor and Frederick A. Middlebush Chair in Political Science at the University of Missouri. And taking another phone call now, we've got Jim joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hello.
Hey, go ahead.
Yes. I want to share my thoughts on health care. First of all, just continue to just be very discouraged by the way it's going. Both personally and with friends, I've been amazed at the degree at which health care affects people's lives. I have one friend who had to retire early because his health care was being changed in order to keep it from a job he liked. I'm supporting two sons for their health care because they're in jobs that don't supply it and they're just starting out, affecting our future. My wife has had difficulty getting insurance because of pre-existing conditions, making the types of jobs she looks for important. And so I have one set of friends who are planning on retiring back in Canada, where one of them had come from, even though their family is here, simply because of the health care advantages there. And I guess as I watch what occurs in Congress and the influence of the special interest, the importance of campaign finance just comes back as you see these people, you know, with big money, big donations just kicking in, and suddenly people's tunes change, and it appears that they're able to block what we all know is the right thing to do with health care for the country.
What do you think it's going to take?
what do I think it's going to take? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think campaign finance would help. I guess that's what I'm saying. I go back to that as the one thing that may help, because they see undue influence on the part of our legislators behaving as politicians who want to get reelected, as opposed to people who stand on principle. And that seems to be the state that we're in today. So I don't have a lot of hope beyond trying to change. And again, that would probably take some different sort of circumstances to get something like that passed, because, of course, you'd face tremendous opposition every time we come look at campaign finance reform.
Okay, thanks a lot, Jim. Marvin Overby?
I guess my first response anytime people start talking about campaign finance reform is just to ask people to focus on the basic fundamental fact that the core reality that we have a First Amendment that guarantees people a right to free expression makes any sort of campaign finance reform difficult. And we've seen that over the past several decades, beginning in 1974 when the Supreme Court is going to strike down part of the initial Federal Election Campaign Act. When you have that guarantee to free speech, and when you have a society that essentially equates money with speech, as we do, then you have a very difficult time trying to regulate the access that those with money have to public officials. And it would be far simpler to do what Jim suggests if we lived in a country like Great Britain, which with its unwritten constitution doesn't have a First Amendment guarantee to free speech. It's much more difficult to try to craft campaign finance reform legislation that passes constitutional muster when you have that very high First Amendment threshold there. So I'm not sure that it's really very constructive to try to think about campaign finance reform as being some sort of panacea to this problem, because it's going to require some sort of constitutional amendment that might do more harm than it would good in the long run.
Let's play this out a little bit. I mean, Congress goes on the August break. They come back. Do you think it's more likely that some form of health care reform will pass? You think it'll get watered down? Or do you think, as we look back at this time, it will start to seem as though health care reform is actually inevitable, as it sort of seems, given certain tipping point factors in the way we look at health care now as a society?
Right. I don't know, Veronica. I don't have a crystal ball, and it's sort of hard to sort of project into the future, even several weeks or several months down the road. My instincts, I guess, would tell me that we're likely to see more compromise and a more watered down version of one of the proposals that's currently being bandied about in the House, the Senate, and that's because that's just the way our system tends to work. In a real sense, we've got an 18th century governmental structure with the separation of powers and the federalist structure trying to deal with 21st century problems. And that means that there are any number of different actors and institutions in the policymaking process: House committees, Senate committees, the House floor, the Senate floor, the bureaucracy, the president, the state governments. Any one of them can effectively put a brake on policy proposal, if not entirely derail it. So you've got to create some sort of system that gets all those different institutions with multiple divergent points of view, with different political agendas. You've got to find something that is going to satisfy as many of them as possible. And that is generally going to be something that is less radical and probably more watered down.
What would that mean for the Obama administration? Is that a huge disaster if we get some watered-down piece of legislation?
I think as a political matter, probably not. They're going to trumpet, as any administration will, they will trumpet anything that passes as an achievement, as an advantage, as an improvement over the current system. And, you know, you saw some of that, I think, being outlined in terms of the Wednesday press conference, when he gave that, I thought, very nicely played analogy of, you know, your neighbor has a car that he paid $6,000 less for. Well, if he can get that number down to $3,000, he's going to trumpet that as quite an improvement over the current system.
Let's go back to the phones right now. Tom joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Good morning. The comment I have is I'm disappointed in Barack Obama because when he did his campaign, he was using text messaging and email and everything to get people fired up about the health care debate. Now, to put pressure on Congress, he needs to start text messaging, bringing his focus groups more empowered into the situation to get them to put contact people in their areas to put pressure directly onto their congressmen regarding this issue, especially introducing the public option and supporting that. I'm very disappointed in what he's doing. I'd also say that if they're going to do that, the thing that they need to add to it is we're not going to vote for you next time if you don't get the public option.
Marvin Overby?
How to respond? Campaigns are run in poetry, and governing is done in prose. I think that a president like Barack Obama has any number of things, any number of agenda items that he wants to be able to deal with Congress on. And we've already seen any number of those before health care was even brought up, the TARP, other sort of physical and stimulus efforts. There are going to be other priorities, education reform perhaps. He's got a Supreme Court confirmee waiting in the wings. Presidents have to deal with members of Congress on all sorts of issues. If a president decides he's going to do what political scientists call going public and sort of ratcheting up the pressure on members of Congress by going around them, essentially, directly to the public and saying to the public, write your members of Congress, tell them that you want to pass my bill, and tell them you're going to vote against them if you don't, that might work in the short run, but it creates the kind of environment in which it's more difficult to get any number of other measures through the Congress in a sort of collegial fashion, perhaps in the long run. The other danger, and I think your caller, sort of ignores this, is that when presidents go public, it is quite possible that they mobilize not their supporters but their opposition. And I think there's reason to believe in this case that while there is a good deal of public support for doing something in terms of health care, public support for doing anything in particular may be softer than a lot of people, especially on the political left, would like to admit.
Well, his ratings are down. Is that indicative of lack of support for his health care plan, or is that people like Tom who thinks he's not getting the job done?
I suspect a little bit of both. I mean, Obama's personal ratings continue to be very high. In this sense, he's somewhat analogous to Ronald Reagan back in the 80s, who was always very personally popular, even when people disagreed with his policies. But I think presidents, no matter what they tell you, they do pay attention to the political polls. And I think he understands that pushing too hard on this could be detrimental to his long-term relations with the U.S. Congress, the Senate, and the House, and it also may be the kind of thing that he's not going to get the kind of overwhelmingly affirmative public response on that you might have thought a couple of weeks or even a couple of months ago.
And one last highlight on this healthcare story is the White House's desire to create this advisory council on healthcare, and that seems to be something that's also proven to be a bit controversial. What do you think about that?
This too, I think, plays into a sort of an underlying societal problem we have. We, as a society, are sort of trapped in a rhetoric, a myth of small government. That we don't want government interfering with what we generally take to be private decisions, that we tend to have this negative view of bureaucrats sort of in the abstract. We hold that at the same time where everyone in the political spectrum, from the far left to the far right, when something goes wrong, they are clamoring for the federal government to step in and do something. I think Americans generally have what I sometimes refer to as a Michelob Light view of government and politics. that we tend to want a beer that is both tastes great and is less filling, and we oftentimes don't see the contradictions there. When it comes to healthcare, there is going to be some form of rationing of healthcare. That can be done on a monetary basis. It can be done on an administrative or bureaucratic basis. We tend to think as Americans that if it's done on a monetary basis, it's not really rationing. But it is. It's just rationed according to who can pay for it. This sort of government gatekeeping body that the Obama administration and others in Congress have pushed would be more of a government rationing operation that is common in essentially all the other advanced industrial democracies' healthcare systems. But we are sort of trapped by our rhetoric that we don't think that's something government should do. And unfortunately, again, especially for people who tend to believe that there's great public clamoring for change here, that support, I think, tends to be soft, especially when it's up against this societal myth about small government.
Let's take another break right now, and then we'll come back. Keep talking with our guest this morning, Marvin Overby, professor and Frederick A. Middlebush Chair in Political Science at the University of Missouri. Talking all things political this morning. So far, we've talked about healthcare reform, the big topic on the table. But, of course, we can talk about Sarah Palin stepping down and the school improvement plan as well when we come back. Our number to call this morning, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call, or our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Veronica Rickert in this week for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up at 11 o'clock today, join Larry Mueller as he talks with UW Green Bay historian Kim Nielsen about the life of Anne Sullivan Macy. She was Helen Keller's teacher and the subject of Nielsen's new book called Beyond the Miracle Worker. And then at 11:45, the weather guys will be in to ponder the effect of El Nino on the weather this winter. That's 11:45, Larry Mueller Show today. I'm Veronica Rickert, glad to be with you this Monday morning on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm in this week for Kathleen Dunn. This morning it's all things political, and we're talking with Marvin Overby, a professor of political science at the University of Missouri. And Marvin, just to leave behind healthcare reform for a moment, another story which has been kind of tucking along this weekend is Sarah Palin had her official, I guess, last day, and a lot of speculation there. The White House sort of going, don't know, don't care what her plans are. Everybody else is pretty interested, though. What do you think?
She's an interesting character, isn't she? I don't have any particular insights into what is motivating her to do what she's doing, other than to make a couple of observations. And one of them is, there are reasons why there are not many nationally prominent politicians from Alaska. It is an unusual state. It has an unusual political culture, and it is just geographically so far removed from the lower 48. If Governor Palin, former Governor Palin, is thinking about a presidential bid for 2012, there may be some value to her of getting out of the governorship, because it is very difficult to both manage a state as far away as Alaska is and be available to the news media and to the political and partisan events that largely occur in the lower 48. If she were still up in Juneau as the Alaska governor, she would find it very difficult to sort of stay in the media spotlight building up to a 2012 presidential run. That's one side. The other side is, Americans, I don't think, are going to generally take kindly to a governor who steps aside, a year and a half remaining in her term. If you believe her, because the pressures of being in that office, it's sort of gotten to her and her family. It's hard to see how you sort of translate that decision into asking people to vote for you for the most stressful mm-hmm. job in the world.
Well, and the timing is interesting because the Vanity Fair article, which took the tone of an expose, came out not that long before she announced her resignation. And in the wake of that, there was speculation about her mental health in terms of postpartum depression, financial troubles. And then you've got other people who think, no, she's got big fish to fry. She's going to go on to have a radio show run in 2012. You know, it's the whole gamut of possibilities, it seems like.
And I guess we're going to see. You know, she has captured the public imagination. I'm not sure she's captured the public imagination in a way that's going to get people to vote for her for president. But I have no doubt we're going to hear a lot about Sarah Palin in the coming months.
Do you see her as leaving Alaska?
I don't know. She has so tied herself to that Alaska persona that I think she's going to have to keep at least a symbolic attachment to that state. And that's going to require spending some time there, of course. And again, that makes it difficult to be a national-level politician.
Let's take another phone call now. We've got Scott joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
Morning.
Just a quick note on Sarah Palin. The unfortunate thing is, you know, and I've been following politics since 76 when Jimmy Carter ran, and like her or dislike her, she has been, and some of it's her own doing, but she has been savaged in the media. I mean, even before she resigned, I mean, the election is 6 months past, and they're still hammering on this poor woman. And I do feel bad for her, but there has been a lot of bias reporting and a lot of negative things about Sarah Palin. My original point has to do with, I think the big news story is how poorly things are going for Barack Obama. I was watching the Sunday morning roundtables yesterday. They were talking about the Newsweek article, the cover saying the recession is over. And George Will made a real good point. Well, if this recession is over, only 8% of the stimulus has been spent, why don't we cancel it and save ourselves $750 billion in debt? His stimulus plan hasn't done anything. And if you really look at the numbers in it and where it's being spent, there's a lot of things that aren't stimulative. So I think this ties in with the American sentiment and how things are going poorly with the health care debate. Here you've got the Obama administration. Their first piece of legislation has been, his first big package has been the stimulus package, and it's doing anything. So people like me are looking at it going, well, then why would I trust him with 16% of the GDP? I mean, the part of the economy. I think things aren't going very well for him, and I think those are reflective in the polls.
Interesting point, Scott. Thank you. What do you think, Marvin Overby, about trusting President Obama with this much money in the economy?
Let me make a point about Scott's observation about Sarah Palin first.
Sure.
If I could. The Chinese have a saying, beware the early arrival of dreams. And I think that Sarah Palin, to a certain extent, got in the same situation as Dan Quayle did essentially a generation ago. She was offered this spot on a national ticket, and she couldn't bring herself to say no to it, even though she wasn't ready. And that's why I think she's gotten such bad coverage in the press, because she was seen as being someone who simply was not ready for the job that the McCain campaign was trying to tell everyone she was ready for, to be just one heartbeat away from the presidency. If she had turned down the offer, she would probably still be one of the most popular governors in the nation. She wouldn't have all this baggage. She wouldn't have the Tina Fey impersonation sitting out there on YouTube for people to watch for the coming decades. And she arguably would have been in a stronger position to have gotten herself sort of geared up for a national-level run on her own timetable, when she could have put in the time and effort to sort of get to know the issues a little better and sort of introduce herself gradually to both the media and the public in a way that wouldn't have sort of had her looking like she was a deer caught in headlights.
But it's worth pointing out that those are kind of the same arguments people were saying about Barack Obama when he entered the presidential race.
Yeah, but he turned out to be much better.
Right? You can say that now, but yeah. She, you know, unless you really, I guess, know yourself and your advisors and the position, that's something that's hard to second guess when you're making that decision to leap or stay put.
Well, but I mean, he had a much different background than Governor Palin. I mean, arguably less political experience than she had. But, you know, coming out of sort of top class education, someone who is used to dealing with audiences, whether it's in the constitutional law school classroom or in the state legislature, used to dealing with the kind of media you get in a big state like Illinois as opposed to a small state like Alaska. I think he was much better positioned for that than she was.
If you listen to her rhetoric on the way out the door, though, it doesn't sound like somebody who's slinking off with their tail between their legs. It sounds like someone who's sort of, I don't know, maybe taking the Obi-Wan Kenobi approach. If you strike me down, I shall become more powerful than you can imagine. I mean, she's got big plans.
Yeah, it's fairly easy to take that kind of attitude when you're talking to a friendly audience. It's much harder when you're talking to a more critical audience. And, you know, she has been in the last couple of weeks essentially dealing with only friendly audiences.
Well, putting that aside right now, what about the rest of Scott's comment about how badly he thinks things are going for Barack Obama?
I think that's probably a bit overstated. On the stimulus, I'm not a huge fan of the stimulus package that was passed, but I think we have to sort of separate the economic impact from the psychological impact. Economists, my friends who are in the economics profession, they sort of routinely poo-poo the stimulus as an economic mechanism. That as Scott suggested, it's stimulus measures oftentimes aren't very stimulative and tend to be more long-run than short-run. Something like what I think figures only 18% of the stimulus money has been spent so far. But I think what that ignores is a very important psychological dimension that, sort of to trope FDR, that the government needs to be seen doing something, and it's almost more that psychological impact, that belief that the government is moving on something, it is doing something, that is going to help restore confidence in a way that's reasonably hard to measure. But probably contributes to economic recovery at least as much as the direct economic benefit does.
I'm curious, you referenced earlier the headline, I guess it was Time magazine, saying that the recession is over. Did you look at the article? Are you buying the argument?
I did like the subtitle, which is, and good luck surviving the recovery, or something like that. I don't know. I think that the American public tends to overreact to things. I'm not sure that the economic situation was ever as dire as it might have looked back in late 2008. And so I have great confidence in the American economy in the long run to produce wealth and jobs and opportunities for people. And so it doesn't surprise me that the recovery is going to happen. Whether it's going to be the kind of sort of massive spike in the economy that we saw in the 1990s, I don't know.
Well, thank you to Scott for bringing up all those great points there. And let's take another call now. This is Ben from Merrill. Hi, Ben.
Hello. Professor Ogilvie, I would just kind of have to take issue with your comment earlier about the money being free speech. I find it just abhorrent that some like the 68 Democratic Convention and the Bush administration not allowing people to be even come to his meetings, his campaign meetings, was just that's free speech. How can it possibly be a policy of the government to have the one be free speech? That's just fine, and the other, no heads rolled, nothing happened.
Marvin Overby?
I'm not sure I understood the caller's question exactly. I would respond, I guess, generally by saying it's not me saying it's free speech. It's the U.S. Supreme Court has declared relatively unambiguously that spending by political candidates is free speech, and that you can regulate that only with great caution.
Tying in with that on our earlier caller about campaign finance reform, we have an email from Tom in Wausau, who says the only way to get special interest and corporate money out of politics is to pass a constitutional amendment barring anyone but a voter from contributing money to a candidate. Your thoughts on that?
It might well be a good idea. I think the courts would probably, well, a constitutional amendment wouldn't necessarily go to the courts. I think anything short of a constitutional amendment, the courts would likely strike down on that, because there's a long-standing tradition in Anglo-American jurisprudence that actually corporations have many of the same rights as citizens.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that, you know, getting a constitutional amendment passed is a very difficult task, and that effort spent in that regard is generally wasted.
And one more email here from Lori in Marionette, who says she heard a report on NPR last week saying that $40 million was spent on health insurance for Congress, and she'd be interested in seeing that info dug up and further investigated. Maybe, I guess that's not really a PR point that President Barack Obama could use, but do you think that's significant?
Well, I think he did, in fact, trumpet that during his Wednesday night press conference, saying that, you know, that both he and members of Congress had very good health insurance. But I think, you know, a general point is that many Americans have relatively good health insurance, and those who do have good health insurance, they have some concerns about this devil they don't know.
Well, Marvin Overby, thank you so much for being with us this morning. It's been great talking with you.
It was my pleasure.
Marvin Overby, Professor and Frederick A. Middlebush Chair in Political Science from the University of Missouri. I want to thank Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and Rachel Owens for answering your phone calls. If you want to buy a copy of this program, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program, I think it's 727D. I'm Veronica Rickert in for Kathleen Dunn this week. Thanks for listening on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.